WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Well, I think the amazing thing is how little they were worried about anything. The same thing goes for every major invention that came along in the communication, telegraph, wireless, radio, phonograph, television, FM too, that immediately it was visualized. I mean, you immediately visualized all the possibilities. And the predictions that were made about radio in 1922 were far and wide that it would be the fulfillment of democracy. We would finally have an enlightened public. It would no longer be possible for politicians to be elected on one platform and do something else because everybody would know what they were doing. And the Secretary of War said, Secretary of the Navy said that radio would make surprise impossible, so we would never again have to worry about the Japanese attacking our Pacific islands. You know, so in other words, it was a general euphoria, and exactly the same thing was true when the phonograph was invented in tremendous euphoria. FM was called Radio Second Chance, and this was going to open the door. The commercialism was going to be no problem, etc. And the same thing with television. Now, there were a few people that worried about things, and it is kind of amusing, but there was very little of that, you see. A few people worried that there would be a monopoly, but a lot of people said there ought to be a monopoly. That is, the Secretary of State said there should be a monopoly. The Secretary of the Navy said there should be a government monopoly. And if it wasn't a government monopoly, it ought to be a monopoly in suitable hands. That is, they all said that radio is naturally a medium that required a monopoly. And the more people were saying that, then we're far worried about monopoly. It's true that the fear about monopoly developed a little bit later on. Now, what else? Oh, yes. Herbert Hoover was worried about commercialism. He said it was when they first began to, you know, the first couple of years, there were no commercials, but then commercial messages began to come in, and a lot of stations were owned by commercial organizations. They began to plug products just a little bit more and more. And Herbert Hoover said that it was unthinkable that this enormous resource for public service should be drowned in advertising chatter.
Well, yeah. Currently, a lot of things are blamed on the media. A lot of problems are blamed on the media. And a lot of people distrust what they see on television or hear on the radio, in part because they've been burned in the past, I think. Well, do you see a certain point in which suspicions and fears started developing within the American public?
Well, again, it was true of each of the media that there was this opening euphoria, and then everything begins to be blamed on it. You know, there was a farmer back in the mid-20s who said that he was working in his fields, and suddenly a bird dropped dead in front of his, you know, equipment, and he said, obviously, one of your waves must have hit him, and he came to the radio station to complain. You know, that all kinds of things were blamed, the changes of the weather and so on. Yes, the fact that everything is blamed, everything was blamed on comic books. Now, there may be some validity in some of these fears. I'm sure there is. I think the general increase in violence probably does have something to do with the fact that we demonstrate violence and we provide models for violence, and the fact that almost every crime that is shown on television, the nature of it, any unusual crime is almost immediately copied. There's very good reason to think that there is a. Now, other people say, well, the kind of crime is copied, but the tendency to perform criminal acts is not caused by the media. Well, that may be true.
What are some of your other concerns about television today?
Well, I'm concerned not so much about television as I am about the commercial domination of television. I think that's a real problem.
You mean the sponsor within television?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Advertising?
Yes.
What I hear said a lot is that the purpose of television isn't to deliver programming to the viewer, but rather to deliver sponsors to an audience. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I think that's the way it has developed, that That well, you can see how it used to be that they sold a period of time by a rate card, and now they don't. They sell 30 seconds here, 30 seconds there, and the price of the 30 seconds depends on how many women and how many men, how many children you can deliver, and it's actually in those terms. An advertiser now actually comes to the network and says, I'm ready to put so many million dollars in spots, and the people I'm interested in are women from 18 to 35, and I'm willing to pay as much as $8 per thousand women in that age range, you see. And I'm not interested in men, in old men. I'm not interested in children, anything that comes in along with those women. I'm not interested in them, you know. So they do get these demographic ratings from Nielsen, which show precisely, or presumed to show precisely, what the breakdown of the audience is in terms of men, women, children, and the age range. And in fact, you can get other information, such as the economic stratum and whether it's more an urban than a rural audience. And the sponsor gets exactly the same kind of breakdown on the people who buy his products. So from the point of view of the common sense of somebody merchandising a product, it makes sense to say, we ought to go out and get the audience that completely matches up with the market for our product. Now, if the network is going to make it its business to provide exactly that kind of opportunity, to say we need more of these women 18 to 35 programs and fewer of these old men programs, then that has a big impact on programming decisions.
There was a time when sponsors bought whole shows and underwrote whole shows, so you knew who Jack Benny's sponsor was,
sure.
Or Fred Allen's sponsor.
And they very often sat in the control room and suggested things, that's right.
Yeah. And they had their name in the title, even like Alcoa Theater,
right.
It was named after the sponsor.
Yeah.
Now, sponsors don't have brand of power anymore.
Yeah.
But in which period do you think they really exerted more control over what we end up seeing?
Well, they exerted a much more direct control over individual programs at that time and interfered with programs. But they had varying tastes. There were some who loved classical music, you see, and some who didn't. Now they have withdrawn from the immediate scene. In a way, their influence is more pervasive now. And the network is aiming for the advertising dollar, is planning in terms of what kind of programs we need to bring in the most revenue. Now, you see, if a documentary has a rating, let's say, of if a documentary will have 30-second slots, which you can't sell for more than, let's say, $12,000 a slot, and some other program, you know darn well it's going to have slots that you can sell for $60,000 or even $100,000. So they go over $100,000 now for 30-second periods. The documentary, obviously, is going to be a loser for the network. So you have more and more of a tendency to say, well, that's not a good documentary. Let's put that on Sunday, so you know where we would maybe, the general tendency is to push away from prime time the things that are not going to get $70,000 slots.
Do you think that the networks have too much power and too much profits?
Well, I hate to say anybody makes too much profit. Everybody wants to make more profit. I think, yes, I think their general influence over... I think what people watch on television has a tremendous influence on their general attitude toward the world. And I think more diversity is tremendously much needed.
Now, whose responsibility would it be, do you think, to keep a watch over the networks? Now, the FCC... they're not mandated to deal with programming. And actually, nobody is. There isn't any overseeing agency saying you're being irresponsible to your viewing public.
Well, you see, there are lots of systems that would insulate the sponsor a little bit more from the programming. Now, let's say, for example, Italy, you see. In Italy, they sell time for commercials. But in the evening, the commercials are all spotted one after the other between 8:30 and 9. And It's a very popular program. Actually, children are allowed to stay up and watch that program, which is called I'll think of it in a minute. But a carousel, it's called Carousello. Children are allowed to stay up and watch that, and then they go to bed. Now, the income from that is purely on so much for the time, and that money goes to the network, which then plans, you see. Now, so there is no relation between the program that the spot is in, and no sponsor is in a position to say, I want to buy 30 seconds, but not in this program. I want it in this program, this program. It isn't in a program. It's separate from programs. Germany has a similar system. So that completely isolates the programming decision from any pressure of that sort.
People want to watch this half hour of straight commercials.
Oh, yes, they do. Yes, they do, yes.
How are they done so that they're enticing? Because the advertisers always assume that during the breaks, that's when you're going to run and get some potato chips.
But it has come to the point where they are so well produced that they are so well financed as they are in this country that major directors produce them. I mean, let's say Claude Lelouch. He's produced commercials for Italian television, and they're very entertaining. They've developed a separate genre. They're absolutely magnificent. Some of them.
How does the quality of the programming in the countries that have that system strike you?
I think that the program is more diverse than it is here. Now, I think the same thing is true in Britain. Now, there's another thing I might bring up. You see, in Britain and in Japan, you have a really strong non-commercial system alongside a strong commercial system. And, we have, unfortunately, a weak non-commercial system, which arrived on the scene late and seldom gets more than 10% of the audience. But both the NHK and in Japan and the BBC hang on to about half the audience much of the time. Now, the result of this is that the commercial system is less commercial than ours. There's the same kind of insulation of the sponsor from. And you see, some of the very best programs that have come over here and which we think of as non-commercial are really commercial programs. Upstairs, Downstairs was a commercial series. And there are an awful lot of things done by the commercial networks in Britain that are very much not unlike the BBC. And the same thing is true of NHK. A lot of strong documentaries, yeah.
Could you envision that model of an isolated area where commercials are working in the United States?
Well, the broadcasting lobby is probably the strongest lobby there is. And I think it's very unlikely that anybody could put that across. You see, now there's the statistics that show how enormously people have accepted television in general. People are watching television all the time. I mean, whatever goes on primetime commercial television is, you know, the catch, the songs people sing all over the country, the jokes they have, the references. Everybody to be up is watching prime time. It's the common shared experience. So it has an enormous momentum. And the profits are fantastic. I mean, there's very few industries where every year you make much more than your investment in equipment. And that's just extraordinary. So the kind of momentum that gives you and the kind of influence it gives you, and it has very close ties to members of Congress. There are members of Congress who own shares in television stations, and they get free time to report to their constituents. So the link between Congress and the broadcast is very strong. And I think it's very unlikely that you can do anything in the foreseeable future to change the system.
Do you think that there should be some kind of agency, maybe not the FCC, that monitors the quality of programming and the content of programming, which the FCC is kept out of?
Well, theoretically, the FCC is supposed to decide whether a station is serving the public interest, convenience, and necessity, and whether, if it is, to renew its license. In actual practice, it has always renewed licenses automatically because how can it possibly know? It doesn't know. It doesn't know what a station out in Arkansas or Kansas is doing. So it's a kind of, the system is a kind of a pretense. Now, so it has been almost always automatic. And, of course, we also the system assumes another myth, and that is that it's a system, it's a local system, and that the station makes the decisions. Well, actually, in commercial television, the station makes very few decisions. Most of it comes from the network, the important programs, the important parts of the day, and the network is not licensed. So there's a kind of a mythology that governs the whole system. And yeah,
a catchphrase of network executives is, well, we give the people what they want. If, you know, if millions and millions of people didn't want to watch Laverne and Shirley or whatever the hit show is at the time, they wouldn't watch it. Obviously, they want it, and we're giving people what they want to see. What do you think might be some of the holes within that argument?
Well, I think that what the BBC always used to say is that we feel it is our duty to give people what they will want when they find out about it. That is to say, if you, you know, it's... Imagine if you... now, most surveys indicate that people depend on television for their information on what's going on in the world. This is their prime source of information on what's going on in the world. Now, this puts in a tremendously important function, which they may not have asked for. They may have said originally, "We just want to entertain people." On the other hand, if the people are going to have any sensible notion of what's going on in the world, then broadcasting is, whether you like it or not, an educational institution. In fact, the most important educational institution in the country, no matter what else it may be. When you run, you can't run an educational institution entirely on the basis of we'll give them what they want. I mean, you can't run a school that way. The presumption is that there's an awful lot going on in the world that they have not the faintest idea about and that they ought to know something about and that will affect the decisions that have to be made by the people as a whole in the coming years.
Do you think that we can expect profit-making systems like the major networks to really care about what's going to be best for the best interests of the public?
No, but of course, when the system was designed originally, it was never supposed to be primarily a profit-making system. That, I mean, if you read the original laws that set up the system, it never even said anything about selling time.
Mm-hmm.
That's not mentioned in any law. This wasn't. Most people now assume that this system was created as an advertising medium. It wasn't at all.
So how did that happen?
It wasn't forbidden. And the stations that began to sell time and make more money began to be able to buy the best talent, and the non-commercial stations were pushed more and more into a corner. And the FCC commissioners in the early history of radio and of television tended to favor the commercial broadcasters in any licensed decisions. And the reason was that they said, well, they're giving the people what they want, because they were getting the largest audience. AT&T started the business of commercial programs, and it was it was very soon popular enough so that AT&T was rounding up the very best talent. You know, at a time when other people were depending on free talent or paying people $10 a performance, AT&T was hiring Will Rogers at $1,000 a program. Now, you know, you see what that would do to the popularity of the program. So it's unquestionably true that when you operate a system commercially, you can corner very, very good talent. Now, you see, the BBC and the NHK have a completely different setup in that they have a license fee. Anybody who owns a set pays a license fee, which most of which goes to the network to pay for the programming. And that means that NHK has an enormous budget in Japan, which is many, many times what our non-commercial system has. So they don't have to worry quite that much about talent expenditures. And we have sort of deliberately kept non-commercial television poor and made it now dependent to a very large extent on handouts from corporations, which have produced some very good programs.
Do you think that public television is fulfilling its mission at this point?
Well, I'm very enthusiastic about public television. I think it could be doing more, but I think it is moving in the right direction in general. I mean, that is to say, it has a lot of so-called cultural material, but it also has a lot of some documentaries. And the sponsor tends to push them toward what is called cultural material, which usually means the culture of other countries. Okay. I think what is most lacking is material that deals with our problems at the present time and our relations with the rest of the world, the most difficult kind of material to produce. Well, now, I think things like the public affairs and news programs that are being done are to some extent very good. And public television has done in... It has done something which the networks have deliberately avoided doing, and that is it has given some exposure to documentaries produced by independents. That is, the networks have made it a policy not to produce any documentary, not to broadcast a documentary which they didn't produce themselves. And this seems to me a terribly dangerous policy. I think we need more points of view. Every documentary reflects a point of view, inevitably. And to say that the points of view of three heads of network documentary departments satisfy that situation is outrageous. Now, you see, networks also have this enormous incentive to stay away from documentaries in general, so they have very few of them. The documentary played an enormously important part when Murrow was running See It Now. But that was, he had a very unique position of autonomy within the network, which nobody has anymore. And he was assured of a period of time. Now the documentary gets bounced around, it is almost always dominated by a network newsman who tells you what to see and what not to see, what to believe, and who pretends to sum up the objective point of view, which is a fiction, really. There is no such thing as an objective point of view. He's generally saying on the one hand and on the other hand, and pretending that the line he draws in between is the revealed truth. Well, there are many points of view on almost every problem, and some of those come out in independently produced documentaries. Now, those documentaries are produced at an enormous sacrifice and determination, because it's very hard but there are fascinating documentaries being produced all over the world, and a few of them are beginning to reach the air through public television, and they have and I think this is a step in the right direction.
The public television and public radio at this point has to rely in large part on its budget on direct listener support.
Yes.
And many people are getting very disgusted at the radio and television pitches that happen a couple of times each year, or more than that, where the people from the station get on the television or radio and say, "We need your money." Everybody's heard what that sounds like.
I think it's a very sad situation.
Yeah. Why do you think it's sad, and what alternatives do you see to it?
Well, I think that the system in Japan and Britain, which I think would be almost impossible to put into effect here because of the strength of the industry, because of the strength of the status quo, is a better system. That is a licensed system, and there are more countries that have such a system. But you pay a small license for having televisions, and in fact, you pay less than most people pay here for being on cable television. So it isn't a very onerous thing, but it would support the system quite substantially.
You don't think people would stand for it?
I don't think it would get that far. I think Congress won't stand for it.
There seems to be this incredible cycle that public media is strapped in now. There isn't, particularly in television, the kind of budget to produce lavish programs that are visually competitive with a lot of the fare from commercial television, and because of that, it might not be attracting the same audiences as commercial television, and therefore it has a harder time raising money, and without the money, it can't make the lavish productions, and I don't know how to ever get out of that kind of cycle.
Well, I'm not too discouraged about it. In some cities, it's very difficult to get non-commercial television system because the signal is poor. You know, I mean, some parts of the country are not well covered. If the equipment was a little better, if it was easier to get, I think it's building an audience, and it is a fringe occupation. But then, let's say the most challenging material has very often been a fringe occupation. So I'm not too discouraged about it.
Okay. You are now the chief of the Motion Picture Broadcasting and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. What mission do you have?
Well, when you're asked to take a job like this, which I was a year or so ago, you don't do it because you have a mission, but you feel that this is an exciting challenge. This is an absolutely enormous archive, 250,000 reels of film, 75,000 titles, and all those recordings. And, of course, a lot of them come in under the copyright law automatically. There is a lot of material that doesn't come into the copyright law where a matter of selection comes into play. And even things coming in under the copyright law, we have to decide whether we want them or don't want them. That is, not everything that's copyrighted goes into our collection, only if we feel it ought to be in the collection available for research. So the kind of question that comes up is one of choosing between a representative collection and an elitist collection. Now, there are some people who would say, why on earth are you keeping Kojak, let's say? Well, we have kept a lot of Kojaks. I think it's representative. I think a lot of programs that I don't like very much are in there, and I think they ought to be. Now, the minute you start trying to favor the things that are best, in quotes, in the opinion of good people, you're in a problem. People threw away endless dime novels, and now the surviving dime novels are in the rare book division of the Library of Congress. So to face it directly, yes, we ought to be keeping some junk, representative junk. We ought to be keeping a collection that reflects what Americans were obsessed with and interested in at this period.
You see it as almost a tool for anthropologists when they study.
Well, yes. I did, at one point, a couple of years ago, assemble a group of historians and sociologists and other social scientists and deliberately put the question to them, 40 years from now, what should a social historian find in this collection? And so they went down the line of the program, and there was nothing that they would give up. They wanted the game shows. They wanted to show people jumping up and down as they learned that they were going to get this kind of equipment, that kind of equipment. They wanted the commercials. They did not want the program stripped of the commercials. They wanted them in context. They wanted to have, and they wanted with the promos and all the other stuff. The mandate that I got from that committee was we want everything. Well, obviously we can't keep everything, but the job as we see it is to keep a representative. And anything that has reached a substantial network audience, we ought to have a good sample of.
Did they give you a sense of what they thought they could learn, for instance, from a game show?
Well, the game show reflects the tremendous the nature of our society as a consumer society, more interested in the problem of consuming products and finding in products the solution to problems. You get that feeling from me. I mean, the game show may, in a few decades, seem like a very bizarre activity of this particular period. I don't know, maybe it won't, but that's not for us to decide. It is certainly an unusual thing that didn't exist a while ago and that does exist now. I think, during World War II, we had an ascetic period when we were doing without a lot of things. And when the quiz programs began after the war, first on radio and then television, just the mere mention of all these tremendous products that were going to be given away was very exciting. Just the idea of possessing them. There was one network quiz program, television quiz program, that gave a catalog as a consolation prize for the loser. Now that, in terms of the economics of the program, was not a terribly difficult thing, but in terms of what had suddenly happened to society that had been living on short rations for some time, everything was rationed, and they were saving their money because they were putting it into war bonds because we were at war, and they were not buying this and they were not buying that. They were doing without. They were making things do. That was the slogan: make it do or do without. And they were doing that. And then we went into a long period where consumer goods were. The pursuit of consumer goods was practically equivalent to the pursuit of happiness, and that's what we were supposed to be doing. And I think maybe we may, to some extent, be passing over that period, but that certainly reflected in the game show and the screams and the excitement as you win, that new kitchen or that new car or that boat. Yeah.
It's certainly an incredible task to think of documenting what comes over radio and television, since they're all constantly broadcasting something, and there's so many different stations.
Yeah. There are some local archives, and in general our feeling has been that we ought to concentrate on network material and let local historical societies deal with the local problems, because we can't.
Are there any materials that you feel confident will withstand the decades? A lot of recording tape falls apart in 10 years.
Yes, that's true. We are doing a lot of experimenting with how to keep tape as long as possible. And the tape will probably last at least 20 years. And if we begin to find that some of it's breaking down, then we have to decide. We're spending a tremendous lot of money on preservation, and that is, we're continually making more permanent copies of things that are going to pieces. And we have a tremendous nitrate program. We have something like 70 million feet of nitrate film in Dayton, Ohio, which we have been managing to convert to safety film at the rate of about 5 to 6 million feet a year. We hope to step that up with new equipment and do it at the rate of 10 to 15 million feet a year and get it all salvaged by the end of the 1980s. But there are other things that then we're going to face the problem of the tapes. Now, the video disc may solve this problem, and it may not be long. Here we are. This is the euphoria of the new medium. The video disc, which is read by a laser beam, doesn't wear out, and it's made of material that may very well last forever. The LP records, we have no fears about at all. They're marvelous. The video disc takes up, it's possible to put onto one disc the size of an LP record, a complete feature film. And it may not be long from now before television programs will be syndicated in that form. Now, when that happens, this will be absolutely a godsend for us, because they will take up much less room, and to play them will not, the Steinbeck destroys the film, and the film destroys the Steinbeck. particularly if there's a lot of stopping and starting and studying the thing, studying individual frames going on. So the video disc read by a laser beam sounds as though it might be an archivist's dream. And besides that, it could be used for non-audiovisual material. That is to say, on the video disc machine that we're experimenting with now, it's possible to come back to any frame that you want instantly, and it's very clear. It's extraordinarily clear, the freeze frame. And you realize that it would be possible, and maybe very practical in a very short time, to put every picture of the Louvre on one video disc, and to use it as a frame-by-frame medium. And then, all kinds of books could be done that way, manuscript collections. So we're studying the video disc with the thought that maybe it's not just a medium for our division, but maybe for other divisions also.
Are there other technologies that you have your eyes on now?
The video disc is the most exciting, by all means, yeah.
Let's look backwards a minute. You've got the nitrate film problem. That the early silent movies were made on what is now very combustible base. Yeah. So how do you keep them from blowing up, which is, I know, a problem with the early nitrate films?
every can is opened at least twice a year and examined for signs of deterioration. And when we see the deterioration, we cut the deteriorated part out. There's enough warning before the dangerous stage of deterioration that if you keep track of it. Now, we also know that you have to maintain a certain temperature and a certain humidity, and so we have to keep track of the temperature and, if possible, the humidity, which is more difficult to do. and then the vaults are separated. That is to say, the equipment is supposed to be arranged in such a way that if one of the we have dozens of different vaults, each of which have a certain number of cans in them, and if something goes wrong in one of them, it is not supposed to affect the others. So there are all kinds of precautions, but we have to be very careful. There have been serious nitrate fires. In fact, the National Archives has had two in the last 2 years.
Do you ever get to see any of the films or television shows that you have stored there?
I see fewer films now than before I joined the Library of Congress. That's one problem. Instead of looking at movies and reading books, I write memos and read memos. But occasionally I manage to look at films.